Ali Abunima is a researcher in social policy at the University of Chicago. He's also on the and American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee and vice president of the Arab American Action Network. He, both of his parents are from Palestine, and he lectures frequently and writes and appears frequently in the media on current issues in the Middle East. Recent op-eds include ones in the Financial Times, the New York Times, and the Chicago Tribune. So, without further ado, I'll leave when you left.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for choosing to spend the next hour or so here instead of at home watching The West Wing, which is something I, like, to my shame, like to do, but I hope I can be as thrilling, exciting, and true to life as the adventures of President Bartlet and his staff, who always do the right thing. Just this, what I'm going to talk about today is the media and the U.S. media primarily, and how it's treated the Palestinian uprising, the new intifada that we've seen over the past 5 months. And it's very fortunate that Al-Awda, the Palestine Right to Return Coalition, invited me to talk about this, because with my colleague Hussein Ibish, we just this morning finished writing a whole chapter for a book on this very subject. I'm not going to read you the whole chapter, but I would like to talk about some of the findings we came up with, and just kind of to summarize what we found. And really, you know, it was surprising. I mean, I think we're all aware that there is that the way this conflict is presented in the media is highly contested. Even on college campuses, and everyone who sees the reports has an opinion on it. What struck us was that 3 weeks into this intifada, this uprising, sometime in mid-October, the Israeli immigration minister and the government that left office today, Yael Tamir, publicly, angrily, very angrily demanded the recall of the Israeli consul general in New York, Shmuel Siso, and on the grounds that she held him responsible for Israel's failure in the press war, which, according to her, we're losing in New York because we are hardly making any effort to get the message out, of course, Israel's message. So one of the questions we set out to answer, Hussein Ibish and I, was whether poor Shmuel Siso was wrongly accused by Yael Tamir, or whether she was right. Well, we'll see. The strongly pro-Israeli Anti-Defamation League, using its own criteria of what constitutes support for Israel and support for the Palestinians, did an assessment of 67 editorials and commentaries in major U.S. newspapers between September 30th and October 15th last year. And they found that 38 of the 67 articles, so well over half, expressed out-and-out support for Israel, in their words. 22 offered what they called even-handed commentary on the situation, so another third, what they call even-handed commentary. And only 7 of the 67, according to the ADL, expressed support for the Palestinian cause. So not even the ADL's definition of even-handed, which includes any article which held the Israelis to be liable in any way at all for what was happening, not even that rather generous definition of even-handed could disguise an overwhelming bias in editorial commentary on U.S. opinion pages. In our study, we looked broadly at the media, but we focused on doing a very comprehensive look at the New York Times and the Washington Post. And we did this because these two papers are certainly the most influential in the U.S. And perhaps even in the world, and they're certainly not read by tens of millions of people, but they're read by the elites, and they do influence the decisions that editors make in papers around the country, and they in a way set the tone for coverage of foreign affairs quite directly. And a lot of papers, hundreds of papers around the country reprint their stuff. So we looked, we did a comprehensive review of all editorials and commentaries between September 28, the start of the Intifada, and the end of January this year. And we divided articles into three categories: those that predominantly expressed clear and unambiguous support for Israel, those that expressed criticism and sympathy for both Palestinian and Israeli positions, and those that were predominantly expressed clear and unambiguous support for Palestinian views. And to summarize the results, they're remarkably close to what the ADL found, which means that, you know, in a sense, there's something real going on here. If me and Hussein, who, you know, we're not going to lie to you, our sympathies are strongly with the Palestinians, and the ADL are coming to similar conclusions, then I think there's something real. So to give you an example, the Washington Post, in this period we looked at, printed 27 op-eds on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, of which 20 were strongly pro-Israeli. About two were what we considered even-handed, and five were strongly or substantially sympathetic to the Palestinians. So 5 out of 27. If you look at their staff editorials, they had 13 unsigned staff editorials in this period. 12 were strongly pro-Israeli, and one was somewhat neutral or even-handed. The New York Times, a similar story. They had 33 op-eds, 25 were strongly pro-Israeli, two, the same number as the Washington Post, were sort of even-handed, and six were mostly pro-Palestinian, so six out of 33. And of the Times' 15 staff editorials, 14 were strongly pro-Israeli, and we categorized one as neutral only because it didn't mention the Palestinians at all and was focusing really on Israeli internal politics. So it would not have been fair to call it pro-Israeli. So we were trying to use a very conservative standard. Just to give you an example, there was an article by President Jimmy Carter that the ADL probably would have categorized as anti-Israeli or even-handed. We categorized it, by Jimmy Carter, and they probably would have categorized it as even-handed. And we categorized it as pro-Palestinian. In other words, we tried to inflate the numbers of pro-Palestinian articles in order to give the maximum benefit of the doubt. Numbers tell part of the story, but I think what's more interesting is when you look at who gets to speak. Both of these papers, and again, this was fairly typical if you take any large metro daily, what I'm saying here applies almost to everyone except one or two that we found. The Both of these papers made considerable efforts to include a wide range of Israeli and Jewish American viewpoints and other authors supportive of mainstream Israeli positions. Palestinian and pro-Palestinian voices were almost completely excluded. To give you an example, the Washington Post printed pieces by Dori Gold, a former Israeli ambassador to the UN and an advisor to Ariel Sharon. They printed an article by David Ivry, Israel's current ambassador to the United States. On one day, they had articles by the former justice minister, outgoing justice minister, and Israeli politician Natan Sharansky on the same day, on the same page, perhaps representing their idea of a debate. There's a whole host of other commentators from pro-Israeli think tanks. By contrast, in the Washington Post, there were exactly three articles written by Palestinians. One was by PLO negotiator Saab Arafat, and it had an interesting headline. The headline was "What We Want," which I thought was sort of summed up a view that the diverse views of the entire Palestinian people could be summed up in one article entitled "What We Want." That ought to be enough for the Palestinians to lay out their case. And not only that, but Arafat's piece was, next to it, they printed a large caricature showing Palestinians with assault rifles. So that they very deliberately undermined the article with this very gross and provocative prejudicial graphic, which prompted Arafat to write a letter to which the Post printed. And he condemned what he saw as, in his words, an insidious and not so subtle attempt by your paper to undermine my words by suggesting that what we want is the exact opposite of what I tried to convey. Very similar patterns of who got included and excluded in the New York Times. I won't go into all the details. Just to make one point about the New York Times that was very interesting, of the six pro-Palestinian articles, two were by Palestinians and three were by Israelis. So even the pro-Palestinian viewpoints are provided by Israelis, and I think that shows the extent to which Palestinian voices are silenced. And then in addition to that, there's a whole host of former U.S. government officials who provide views. Aside from that, it has to be said that the staff columnists of all the major papers, particularly the big two, give Israel what you might call a home team advantage. There are really stables of ardently pro-Israeli columnists, people like George Will, Charles Krauthammer, William Sapphire, Jim Hoagland, Anthony Lewis, and Thomas Friedman. Thomas Friedman's a very interesting case, and he really occupies a unique position among American journalists. He wrote, in the period we looked at, 11 columns inspired by the Intifada, and which demonstrated his signature glibness and arrogance, which many people have commented on. But also a tension between his acknowledgement of harsh realities on the ground facing Palestinians. I mean, he had a column, I think it was yesterday, which demonstrated this perfectly. The first half of it showed a very real knowledge of the hardships Palestinians face on the ground. And then the second half of it was this effort to fit these inconvenient facts into this framework of dogmatic ideology that he has. He's the apostle of two forms of colonialism, a 19th century form called Zionism and a 21st century form called globalization. So his explanation for everything is that these people are just unwilling to accept globalization. So this was his explanation yesterday for the Intifada. Very strange. We also looked, that's just to provide you an overview of the scale of what we're talking about, but we also spent a lot of time looking at really the content and the particular themes that come through, and I'm just going to go through some of the things that were striking and pervasive in a lot of the editorial commentary and reporting of the Intifada. One of the most striking, I mean, is that it's, if you look at coverage of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in much of the world media, in the French, in the British press, in certainly in the Middle East, it's taken for granted that there is a situation of military occupation in place, and that events on the ground should be interpreted against the background, against this context of military occupation. The term "the occupied territories" derives directly from UN Security Council resolutions. As far as I'm aware, the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip and Golan Heights is the only case of belligerent military occupation currently recognized by the UN Security Council. That's not to say there aren't other similar situations, but according to the international law, Turkey and northern Cyprus may be another one. But this is clear that there's an international consensus on this. But you would not know it from looking at the U.S. media. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting did a study of 99 reports from the three major television networks in the U.S. Which mentioned the West Bank and Gaza Strip between September 28th and November 2nd. And what they found was that only four of those 99 reports, so about 4%, informed viewers that Israel was militarily occupying the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Fair also noted that the same networks during the Iraq-Kuwait crisis routinely referred to Iraqi-occupied Kuwait. This was not language that was foreign to them at that time. So they completely deprived their viewers of that context. When, on October 7th, the UN Security Council voted 14-0 to condemn Israel's use of excessive force and referred to Israel as the occupying power and called on Israel to abide by the Fourth Geneva Conventions, this was almost completely ignored in the U.S. media. And of 36 of the 36 largest U.S. papers, only three actually reported on the U.N. vote. And then another pattern we see is simply suggesting that the occupation doesn't exist anymore. I heard this on NPR on the drive up here today from Chicago, where Daniel Shaw, in his commentary, said that one of the options the Israelis are considering is reoccupying the West Bank. You know, I'm sure that the Palestinians in Jericho and Birzeit, who woke up in recent days to find a 2-meter-deep ditch surrounding their entire towns, were not aware that the occupation had ended. But this is typical. The Washington Post, in an editorial, suggested that negotiations between Palestinians and Israelis had to succeed because, quote, the possibility of reverting to the pre-Oslo days of occupation and violence is almost unthinkable. Thomas Friedman picks this up when he accuses the Palestinians of of having, quote, unfurled all the old complaints about the brutality of the continued Israeli occupation and settlement building, as if these are really very minor points which the Palestinians should just get over. Another very common thing, at times when mention of the occupation can't be avoided, is to cast it as simply, you know, it's all a matter of perception, it's all purely subjective. So CNN, back in October when President Clinton brokered this ceasefire in Sharm el-Sheikh, CNN reported that Palestinians were unhappy with it because, quote, they believed it did nothing to end what they see as Israel's occupation of their land. That's a way to make it an entirely subjective, it's a matter of opinion, simply. So with the context invisible, violence by Israeli occupation forces and settlers against Palestinians can then be described largely as defensive or retaliatory, which is the common way we see it being described. And all Palestinian violence can therefore be defined as aggressive and terrorist. You can only do that if you make the fact of belligerent military occupation invisible. Another feature of this is the description of Israeli settlements in occupied territories, which are there in violation of international law and so on, were consistently referred to as Jewish neighborhoods. Beit Jela is a staging area for attacks on the Jewish neighborhood of Gilo, a Jerusalem southern tip, is an example from the New York Times. So this is another way of obscuring the fact that these settlements are there by virtue of and maintained by a belligerent military occupation and could not be there otherwise. And these reports tend to portray settlers and Palestinians as if they are neighboring communities who are equally at risk and equally frightened of each other, sort of putting them on equal grounds, without betraying the fact that Palestinians face far greater risks than settlers. And this is clear from figures given by the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, that from the first intifada, which began in December 1987, until the end of September, so not including any of the deaths in the past 5 or so months, the number of Palestinians killed in the occupied territories by Israelis was 1,487. The number of Israelis killed in the same period by Palestinians inside the occupied territories was 169, of whom 76 were occupation soldiers on duty, which goes to show that occupying another country is not entirely risk-free. Sometimes you get killed doing this. It's dangerous work. But clearly the risks are much greater for the occupied population than for the occupier. Certainly the current intifada not only bears that pattern out, but exaggerates it considerably. One of the, I'm not going to give you everything, I'm just going to give you some of the most salient points. There's more than I could possibly get through in the time I have. But certainly one of the most common and really egregious charges made by Israel and by echoed by pro-Israeli commentators was that Palestinians alone are to blame for the fact that they are being shot by the Israelis, and particularly that Palestinian children are being shot because their parents are deliberately sending them out to be killed and their parents want them to die. And this was quite common on the pages of respectable and not so respectable newspapers. Some examples. The Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel, just to take a regional newspaper, put it like this. They said of Arafat, he has returned to a tactic from the past, to rile up the masses, send them out to their deaths as martyrs, then tearfully parade their bodies before the world. Charles Krauthammer, who said some telegenic massacre to rally the world to his side would be Arafat's fondest wish. So, you know, they're posing as people who are shocked and horrified by the deaths, but, you know, the deaths are there because of this tactic. The child sacrifice notion really originated with, in this case, with an Israeli columnist and broadcaster, Dan Margalit, who, writing in the Israeli paper Haaretz, called for an Israeli public relations offensive that would shift the moral responsibility for the deaths of so many Palestinian young people and children away from the Israeli army that killed them and onto Palestinians, whether the leadership or the parents' own children. And he suggested that, quote, in order to reduce the gap between the cold logic on Israel's side and the bloody photograph giving Palestinians the edge, a planned and creative PR campaign would attack Arafat from an unexpected direction, that he sacrifices children. If all officials repeated this contention, some of those graphic photos would work against Arafat. And this was picked up and repeated quite seriously in major papers. The official Israeli propaganda invented a system where Palestinian attacks on Israeli outposts came in waves. I mean, this was all organized, and this is how the Israelis describe it in a briefing document given by Israeli embassies and consulates to the media. It says, quote, armed Palestinian policemen and members of the Fatah militia, the Tanzim, often stand just behind this human shield of juvenile martyrs and direct gunfire at Israeli soldiers, knowing they can exploit the children's wounds for their propaganda purposes. So this is now applying Dan Margalit's philosophy. We were not able to find any reports from journalists on the ground that confirmed this version of events. And Jessica Montel of the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, which looked into this specifically, reported, quote, that the organization has found no evidence of organized exploitation of children during the Intifada. This argument is really based on simply a racist dehumanization of Palestinians, that, you know, you have to believe Palestinians are less than human to believe that anyone would send their children out to be sacrificed. It requires you to believe that they are not like other human beings. They are not like you. And in fact, this is pretty common. It was the same strategy was adopted by Southern segregationists to justify turning dogs and water cannons and sometimes much worse on children in Birmingham during the civil rights movement, and ironically by British forces who killed Jewish teenagers in Palestine during pro-Zionist disturbances in the late 1940s, and most recently by the South African government during the 1984-85 uprising against apartheid. To give you an example of this, the Los Angeles Times reported, now remember the quote I gave you from the Israeli Foreign Ministry document a few minutes ago. In fact, I'll read it again. Armed Palestinian policemen and members of the Fatah militia, the Tanzim, often stand just behind this human shield of juvenile martyrs and direct gunfire at Israeli soldiers, knowing they can exploit the children's wounds for their propaganda purposes. Now take the Los Angeles Times reporting on South Africa in 1985. Senior South African police officers have complained recently that their efforts to deal with unrest are hampered by the riotous' tactics, including the use of women and children as human shields, the absence of suspected leaders from the front lines of most protests, and the increased attacks on police. It's almost verbatim what you were getting from the apartheid government in the 80s. But none of this stopped these claims from being repeated in the most respected newspapers in the country without any outrage or comment that this was unacceptable. Fine example is in the Los Angeles Times. Edward Luttwak wrote, Arafat's countermove was to, you know, to countermove to Barak's generous peace offers, was to mobilize Arab solidarity and worldwide sympathy by sending Palestinian youths and children to stone Israeli soldiers while his men shot at them, knowing that some would die in the crossfire in front of the television cameras. So the problem is that this logic only goes so far. It can't really disguise the fact that you have dozens of Palestinians dead and only a handful of Israelis. So this has to be dealt with in some way. In fact, we found that the reporting, in contrast to the comment and opinion, was often fairly good. It wasn't always excellent, but it was competent. As to the point sometimes where you wondered if the editorialists were actually reading what was being reported in their own newspapers. I mean, it was two separate worlds. But there were some patterns which were quite consistent, which was that reports about the deaths of Palestinians are typically very vague, very impersonal, sometimes simply non-existent, while deaths of Israelis were often prominently reported, humanized, details of the victims' life and death were given. And this is something we found consistently. To give you one example from one particular day early in the uprising, on October 4th, at least seven Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces, bringing the total at that point to about 60. Coverage, and this was very early, this was the first week, so this was still big news. The front page of the New York Times the next day featured a lengthy article about U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's meeting with Arafat and Barak in Paris. And it was only on page 10 that there was an article describing the violence that had occurred. And only in the ninth paragraph, on page 10, did they mention, quote, for the second time in 5 days, a small boy was killed at the crossroads near Netzarim, a Jewish settlement in the Gaza Strip, where Israeli troops again battled snipers and rioters with rockets and automatic weapons fire. The boy was identified as Mohammed Abu Asi, 9, who witnesses said had been seen throwing stones at the heavily fortified Israeli army post there. An example, one of my favorites from National Public Radio, is Linda Gradstein, who reported on November 1st, this is now about a month into the Intifada, November 1st had been one of the fiercest days of fighting since the clashes began almost 5 weeks ago. And the description she gave is, quote, 6 Israeli soldiers were injured and pinned down for several hours before the army was able to evacuate them. There was also heavy fighting in the Gaza Strip. Israeli troops shot dead 3 Palestinians, all teenagers. So she gave considerably more attention and detail to 6 wounded Israeli soldiers, and at the end mentions 3 dead children. And this is quite consistent all the way through. I'm going to skip over a section here, but another thing we found is that when Israelis died, there were often reports on the funerals where you would get a lot of very emotional reporting, quotes from family members, a lot of details about their lives, which was almost never the case for a Palestinian, especially the many Palestinian children. Everyone is familiar with Mohammed Ad-Durra, the 12-year-old boy whose death was filmed on TV. That was an almost unique case of a Palestinian victim being humanized and given a name. But many media outlets took seriously Israeli claims that the boy was caught in, quote, crossfire, and they reported these claims faithfully. They even reported that he had earlier been throwing stones, as if this would justify shooting at him for 45 minutes when he was clearly pinned down and pleading for his life. And this was despite a lot of testimony that there was, that it wasn't crossfire, that they were targeted in that area. But Israeli claims tended to slide without much examination. But a lot of the skepticism with which the Palestinian claims about Mohammed Ad-Durra were treated disappeared when the two Israeli reservists were killed in Ramallah, and this horrible, gruesome scene of one of them being thrown out of the window, where the Israeli claims that these soldiers had managed to wander past several military checkpoints into the center of Ramallah undetected were simply accepted wholesale and never questioned. And the outrage, I mean, that was a gruesome killing and gruesome images, but what we found is that the outrage that was expressed over those killings was absent for 100 Palestinians who died in the previous 2 weeks, more than a third of them children. But there was this great outpouring on the editorial pages when the two soldiers were killed. This pattern of emphasizing Israeli deaths and de-emphasizing Palestinian deaths is really reflects, I think, a widespread pattern whereby people with whom reporters can identify, people who are seen as Western or like us, are humanized. And in the Middle East, this really includes only Israeli Jews. You see this in the U.S., certainly in Chicago, where I live. If there's a murder on the north side of a white college student, it's big news, and you know every detail, and a lot of information for weeks and weeks on that case. But if a black youth is murdered on the south side, it's treated in a very routine, very cursory way by the media. So these kinds of patterns, which are really racially based, are not so unfamiliar to us. One of the consistent claims of the Israelis is that the Israelis apply very strict rules of engagement for their army. As the Israeli ambassador wrote in the Washington Post, Palestinians are propagating the fallacy that Israeli troops meet demonstrators with live fire. Rather, Israel has shown the greatest restraint possible, and an Israeli soldier may respond only when shot at first or in a life-threatening situation. This was accepted almost universally by U.S. opinion pages, despite considerable evidence to the contrary, not least an article today in the Israeli paper Haaretz by Israeli journalist Amira Haas, who was in Gaza, and she said that bullets, the Israeli army, who are at a settlement right adjacent to a Palestinian refugee camp, they open fire. If a Palestinian kid shouts an insult at the soldiers shoot. If the soldiers are coming in and out of their compound, they just spray the area with gunfire. This was reported today in the Israeli press, and we found a number of reports consistent, not just from reporters but from human rights groups. These facts were not able to permeate the myth of Israel's purity of arms, which is that Israel only acts in self-defense, that Israelis are acting with... in fact, that shooting at Palestinians hurts Israelis more than it hurts anyone else, because Israelis so much hate to use force that they feel a real pain. This was a very consistent pattern. One of the things I found most egregious was, you know, when it just became too plain, you would find some criticism in the Washington Post, the New York Times, for example, always couched, always tentative. So, for example, the Washington Post acknowledged that Israel's measures against the rioters are sometimes excessive, but it said Israel's use of helicopter and missile attacks on Palestinian towns and cities were largely symbolic. Now, of course, the Palestinian small arms fire from Beit Jala to the settlement of Gilo, which barely reached Gilo and shattered some windows in Gilo and wounded an Israeli policeman, was of course not described as symbolic. It was described as terrorism, aggression, Israel under siege. How can Israelis be expected to live when their settlements are coming under this attack? So this actually symbolic Palestinian gunfire, since it did shatter some windows, and it could have killed someone, it didn't, but could have, is a major aggression. And certainly the news that these missile attacks and helicopter attacks were symbolic would have come as real news to the family of the many dead, including that of 28-year-old Wael Mohammed Ghnaim, who was one of the first to be killed by an Israeli helicopter while he was standing in front of his home in the village of El Qadr. Certainly he wasn't aware that the attack was only supposed to be symbolic. I'm going to summarize the other. I wanted to focus on some of these principal themes. Some of the others we will talk about. Buy the book, it comes out in September. I think there's another author here who has a chapter, Jennifer, who's a member of the faculty, doesn't have a title yet, but it's coming out in September from Verso, and it's about the Palestinian uprising, so look out for it. Extreme demonization of Palestinians, particularly Yasser Arafat, one of the most interesting phenomena, and you see this with Saddam Hussein and Milosevic, was turning the enemy leader, who is often, Yasser Arafat is certainly one of the most pathetic and powerless leaders in the world, if you ask me, but turning him into this omnipotent figure who is really the puppet master and controls not just the Palestinians who react his orders like robots, but also is responsible for everything that happens in Israel. Israel is, in fact, helpless before him. You see this in, when Barak called the election, it's now up to Arafat to decide the result of the election. Will Sharon be elected or Barack? Well, that depends on what Yasser Arafat does. We even had in the New York Times the claim that Arafat's influence is so great it extends to the whole Middle East. For example, Thomas Friedman, who says that who warned President Mubarak of Egypt that unless Egypt warmly embraces Israel, this would leave Egypt and other Arab regimes vulnerable to Yasser Arafat's inflaming their public opinion and bringing people into the streets, I mean, from Cairo to Casablanca, where they could start protesting all sorts of things besides Israel. His influence even extends to the United States. William Safire warned in the midst of the U.S. presidential election dispute that, quote, America's mind is fixed on its own affairs, but thanks to Arafat, whoever wins the White House is sure to have a stressful first 100 days. So leave aside all the other things the new president will have to deal with. Yasser Arafat is the one who will set the agenda for the American president. When all other explanations for the Palestinian uprising failed, then quite a number of commentators resorted to the cliché of the clash of civilizations. This line of argument has certain advantages because it allows you to ignore all of the details of the conflict. It allows you to sidestep things like occupation, things like excessive force, all of these things. And you get to talk about this notion originated by Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington that sees the West as a coherent, distinct, and superior segment of humanity which is being increasingly challenged by very dangerous Islamic and Confucian civilizations. So that all conflicts involving Westerners and Arabs or Muslims are thus reduced to episodes in a trans-historic and global struggle between Western civilization and its Islamic antithesis. So in this case, to apply it to this conflict, you then represent Israel as the outpost of Western civilization. So we had the columnist Rod Dreher, admittedly in the New York Post, one of the lowliest papers in the U.S., who says, as the only outpost of the West in that irrational desert, we owe the Israelis our loyalty in what is likely to be a long and painful time of trial by fire. The Israelis, whatever their failings, are fighting for us and for our civilization. Americans used to understand that. Arafat and his mob are reminding us once again of what's truly at stake here. This isn't a clash of Palestinian mobs versus Israeli troops. This is a clash of civilizations, and it's far from over. Now, that was the Post, but it wasn't only the Post, the New York Post. The Investor's Business Daily, of all papers, asked, just what makes Arafat so unfazed and emboldened? The answer was, much of the Islamic world, the politicized part of it, has rallied behind him. Their aim, deny Jews any sovereign territory. Their favored acts of militancy, the destruction of Jewish holy shrines. And they conclude by chiding the Clinton administration for resisting the clash of civilizations analysis. And they say, a mere decade ago, pre-Clinton and post-communism, some pundits chattered about the end of history, a period when all disputes would be resolved politically. Others, remembering a history when Islam dominated Europe and much of Asia, warned of the coming clash of civilizations. Apparently, the Clinton-Gore administration absorbed the more hopeful view. The cost now in the making looks horrendous. There are lots of examples. I won't give you them all, but there was one which I particularly enjoyed from the Dallas Morning News, Well, William Murchison writes, I mean, here you really get everything. An aptitude for suicidal behavior is among the more disquieting traits of the Palestinian radicals. It calls to mind Imperial Japan's kamikaze pilots, hurling themselves at American ships, knowing they themselves were to die, not caring a rap, doing it for the greater glory of something. A culture that breeds this kind of fanaticism and moral lunacy, as Imperial Japan bred it, along with death marches, beheadings, and so on, is a culture that at the very least you want to approach with some wariness. You can't tell when, like a mad dog, it will turn and bite. And he actually provides a prescription. The goal we Westerners seek for the Middle East is peace. What we might more usefully desire for the region is civilization. Well, I have to give you one more. Just one more. This is from the from Emmett Tyrell Jr. And he says, "Call me an American know-nothing, but I concluded that history and politics had landed the Jews on a plot of ancient land where they were to live cheek by jowl with peoples who are warlike by nature and adherent to a religion that encourages bellicosity or jihad, to use the official term. For good measure," he adds, "one of Islam's cultural treasures is a torture device known as the bug pit." Has anyone ever heard of that? That's what I thought. I thought Indiana Jones. I want to end with a few comments on the whole the background to the Intifada, and that is, of course, the Camp David negotiations. The whole framing of the Camp David negotiations is that that at Camp David, Barak had presented Palestinians with an incredibly generous offer, which was wantonly spurned by a Palestinian, intransigent Palestinian leadership, who then launched an irrational campaign of anti-Israeli violence. It has to be said that unless the many commentators and journalists who espouse this view have details which they have yet to share with the public, none of them who claimed to know what was on offer really did, because there was never any firm plans either offered at Camp David or given to the public. An important example: at no point during or after the negotiations did either the Israelis or the United States present the Palestinians with detailed maps of their proposals for a Palestinian state. Even the Israeli press repeatedly complained that Barak was giving the Israeli public only vague proposals and no details. And when some generalized maps did surface, they showed anything but generosity. The salient features of the Palestinian state, so-called state, would have had no territorial contiguity, no external borders, limited control of its own water resources, and no full Israeli withdrawal from occupied territory as required from by international law. Now, for Palestinians, a basic thing, if they're going to accept a state in the whole of the West Bank and Gaza, let's say, that represents for them a considerable compromise, because the West Bank and Gaza are only 22% of what of the land of Palestine, which they once overwhelmingly dominated numerically and in terms of where they lived. So given the fact that the Palestinian negotiators went in to the negotiations recognizing Israel within its 1948 borders, not making any claims over that territory or over West Jerusalem, from which over 30,000 Palestinians fled or expelled, that they had shown ample willingness for compromise. This was, needless to say, not appreciated by the American press. And the New York Times was typical as speaking of Barack's government as one, quote, willing to offer the most generous compromise terms possible under the current political circumstances. Of course, the only political circumstances under consideration were Israel's. I'm going to skip over a lot and just point out one thing that irks me a great deal, which is repeated references to the Israelis reportedly being willing to give back 95% of the West Bank. This number was cited everywhere. Almost none of the reports pointed out that this so-called 95%, which again was not based on any maps, was based on Israeli spin and talking points, was based on Israel's own definition of the West Bank, which is completely arbitrary. They excluded from it the whole of what they call Greater Jerusalem. They included in what was to be given to the Palestinians the surface of the Dead Sea, which, if any of you are familiar with the Dead Sea, you can't even fish in it. And all these kinds of tricks. I mean, the definition of the West Bank under international law is all the territory which was under the control of Jordan prior to Israel's occupation. So when there were some analyses done by the Foundation for Middle East Peace, they projected that Israel's proposal, Israel would actually withdraw from only 80% of the West Bank, a significant difference. And their analysis of Clinton's proposals was that the Palestinians would get at most 86.5% of the West Bank. They also didn't point out the fact that Israel would continue to lease the Jordan Valley and would be able to station. I mean, all of these crucial details, which are the difference between having real independence and not, were simply ignored. Thank you very much.